Welcome to Onglithe On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Morrow. Onglithe On Air is a podcast from Onglithe, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onglithe covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, supported by Pfizer and Novartis, we had the pleasure of speaking with the panelists from Onglithe's inaugural Women in Oncology event, which took place during the 41st Annual Miami Breast Cancer Conference. Stephanie L. Graff, MD, is the Director of Breast Oncology at Lifespan Cancer Institute, as well as an Associate Professor of Medicine at Brown University, both in Providence, Rhode Island. Reshma L. Matani, DO, is a medical oncologist at Miami Cancer Institute and Chief of Breast Medical Oncology at Baptist Health's Wellness and Medical Complex in Florida. Kelly E. McKen, MD, PhD, is a breast medical oncologist and an assistant clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, Health David Geffen School of Medicine. Hope S. Rugo, MD, is the Winterhoff Family Endowed Professor in Breast Cancer at the University of California, San Francisco, as well as a professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology and Oncology, and the Director of Breast Oncology, Director of Clinical Trials Education, and Director of Cancer Infusion Services at the UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Graff, Matani, McKen, and Rugo shared moments throughout their lives and careers that sparked their interest in oncology, setbacks they overcame when building their careers, obstacles they continue to encounter as women in the field, and ways that gender bias can be confronted at both the individual and institutional levels.
I feel like my path to becoming a woman in oncology has been a bit winding at times. I grew up in a small town in rural Missouri. Both of my parents are not doctors. My dad has an eighth grade education, and my mom worked in a factory actually for a big part of my childhood. And so when I decided that I wanted to be a doctor, they really didn't have any guidance or support for me. I applied to medical school. I only applied to medical school. I went to a six-year combined BA-MD program because I thought, well, if I'm going to be a doctor, I should just go to medical school. Luckily, that worked out because I didn't really have a backup plan. Then when I got into medical school, I really loved the science of oncology. I loved the pharmacology, the pathology, the just every part of it. And one of my mentors had told me that your job is to read about your job, so you have to love what you read about. Your job will be to read about your job. So I did just really connect with oncology. Then as I started going through fellowship and looking for jobs, I actually did not think I wanted to do academics. So my first job was in community oncology. But I really had loved research. I thought it was important to have trial options for patients to expand the knowledge base and help, you know, move our field forward. And so the site that I joined was a community NCORE. I ended up really loving working on community trials and accruing patients to trials, had some success with that, which led to ultimately partnership and leadership opportunities within the Sarah Cannon Network. And I ended up being with Sarah Cannon for 10 years, which, although not a traditional academic center, clearly does a ton of research and are pioneers in research themselves. And now at this mid-career point, I was ready for a new challenge and a transition to the team at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, and have the opportunity to help them grow as they move toward their road to becoming an NCI-designated cancer center. And so I think that there's been ups and downs on that journey. And, you know, I think that that's what a lot of people's path looks like, is that it's hard at times and surprising at times and easy at times. And where you end up is not always where you thought you would. And I think that keeping that open, flexible mind just keeps opening doors to you. I think career challenges that I've particularly faced: my brother died when I was in medical school, right as I was going into my residency match. And so although I had originally planned to look more broadly for internal medicine residencies, the death of my brother right at that time really meant that it was important to me to stay close to home, to be a support to everything that was going on with my family. So that significantly changed what residency match looked like for me. Then as I was in fellowship, I actually had started out as a thoracic oncology researcher. I had been doing lung cancer research, and my mentor changed institutions. And so I started looking for new opportunities to connect with a mentor. And I sort of very accidentally found my way into the breast oncology department and asked them to become my new mentors. And here I am now as a breast oncologist. So clearly that was a happy accident of finding a new mentor. Similarly, you know, at the time that I started my community oncology career, I did not think I wanted to be an academic medical oncologist. I had specifically chosen a non-academic career, and then just had tremendous success and enjoyment doing clinical trials with the Sarah Cannon team, and you know, fortunately had lots of opportunities and was able to stay very engaged in the clinical research community, both through Sarah Cannon and opportunities through the American Society of Clinical Oncology, that when I decided that I was ready for that change, the door was still open. And now, you know, here I am at an academic medical center in a leadership role. So, I mean, I think that there have been sort of setbacks and big changes, and I've had a little bit of luck and a little bit of perseverance to turn those moments on their heads.
Early on in my education and career, I encountered several challenges that I would say tested my perseverance and adaptability. One significant challenge was during my college years, my father suffered a major heart attack, and balancing the rigorous demands of school and my personal and family responsibilities was extremely stressful. My planned career path didn't go as smoothly as I had hoped, but that struggle actually allowed me to take a close look at my goals, my true interest in medicine, and ultimately it was a period of growth and development, which I can appreciate when looking back. I also think that my time interacting with the healthcare team on the other side of where I sit these days was extremely valuable, because by experiencing those certain moments of uncertainty and vulnerability myself, it taught me lessons about empathy and patient care. And I think I gained a deeper understanding of the fears and concerns that my future patients have faced. And I feel that this insight has fueled my commitment to providing compassionate and comprehensive care to every individual that I treat.
I'm from a small town in rural East Texas where the high school graduation rate is less than 50%, and I escaped a long time ago through education. I went to Rice, did biomedical engineering, then I went to Stanford on a medical scientist training program, grant from the NIH, and there I studied cancer biology, went to OHSU for internal medicine, and then to UCLA for fellowship in hem-onc. So now I'm a breast oncologist. I've been doing that for about 7 years. I do a lot of clinical trial research, but I'm also very interested in translational research because of my background in molecular biology. Growing up, my mom has had breast cancer twice, and her sister had had breast cancer in her 40s. Their mother had had breast cancer, so it was always a part of my life, and it was always not something that was devastating. It was just something that is part of your life. You learn from it, you move on from it, and so that has really interested me in breast cancer in the first place. And when I was at Rice and doing biomedical engineering, I was studying to do either a PhD in bioengineering or pharmacology. But when I discovered these programs through the medical scientist training programs, that was when I really started to get into this idea that I could have funding for my whole career in both medicine and as a scientist, and in that way pay for med school. So that's how I kind of snuck in to doing medicine. And when I was in med school, I really discovered that I really liked to see patients, which was not my original intention. I mean, I wanted to be a unicorn until I was 7 years old and then a chemical engineer. So I wasn't one of those who was born to be a physician. That kind of hit me later. So I've kind of adapted over time to learn how to be a doctor.
The road to oncology for me really came up. I wanted to be a doctor from when I was a little kid watching television shows that nobody listening will remember because they were really old shows. thinking about what I wanted to do in medicine, I was thinking about international health and infectious diseases. But when I was training, I really was fascinated by oncology. And we had a lot of exposure to malignant hematology rather than solid tumor oncology when I was training, because that's the inpatient side. And when I was training, we didn't have a lot of the outpatient subspecialty clinic exposure, which people do now, which is much better. You know, I thought really the oncology was the constellation of treating the whole patient and also understanding biology and scientific advances, and, you know, was sort of the combination of being a doctor, in my idea of being a doctor, treating the whole person, but at the same time having the translational academic component where you're really trying to tailor treatment to further understanding. And, you know, when I went into oncology after my fellowship, I went into actually malignant hematology because I was really interested in the immune system. It's funny how it's all come, you know, roundabout and full circle, but I was very interested in immunology from work in the laboratory. So I did malignant hematology and bone marrow transplant, started our stem cell harvesting program, did some selection studies for myeloma. It was really early days of autologous transplants. And we also joined the National Marrow Donor Program and did unrelated marrow transplants, a very difficult thing still. And it was really quite fascinating. But during that time, you know, we were doing transplants, autologous transplants for breast cancer, and I became really interested in the biology of breast cancer because when I had been a medical student, my mother had been diagnosed with stage one breast cancer, and endocrine therapy wasn't given for small tumors in 1982, but she developed recurrent disease before my first child was born. So it would have been shortly after there were studies suggesting that patients with stage one tumors benefited from adjuvant endocrine therapy, but it was very early days in that. She developed metastases to bone, and being involved in her treatment and understanding what was going on with her cancer compared to the patients I was seeing in clinic for transplant made me feel as though the treatment for breast cancer was really quite complex. It was the most common cancer of women worldwide, and there was so much to understand about the biologic differences between different tumors. You know, we just had learned about HER2 overexpression from studies in the late 80s. And then my mother eventually died of her disease, but the course of her treatment was really difficult. I had little kids, was working all the time in transplant, and I just felt like we didn't have the right understanding of what we were doing. We didn't have as many treatment options. AIs, aromatase inhibitors were new. We didn't understand how to manage the toxicity. And although the oncologist was a lovely person who took care of my mother, I moved her out and she lived with us when she was sick. And so it was somebody at my own institution. They didn't really manage the process of progressive disease and pain management. And what do you do when somebody is dying and how much treatment do you give? And all those things were just really not managed well. So at that point, I just made a lateral career move. I thought, okay, I can do something that is maybe more meaningful to me and where I can maybe contribute more than what I'm doing here. And so I moved to breast cancer now about 25 years ago. And it was really a fabulous career move. And it was after my mother died, but I still really attribute that whole move and where I am and the really tremendous opportunities I've had to my mother, my relationship with my mother. So that was really an interesting time. So your mid-level career, you know what you were doing, and you move to something where you don't know anything, you know, except for what I learned from transplant. So that was one big challenge that I had. Certainly the challenge of being in academic medicine, caring for an ill parent and having small children is enormous. And for women, it is huge, and it's still a huge issue. There is not a lot of flexibility in academic medicine. Now, that's improving now, I think. It's really a lot better. We have more women in academics. I think there's a real push to try and allow people the time off they need. There's maternity leave, which there wasn't any maternity leave in our sort of documents for being hired in when I had kids. So it was really a new experience. Now people routinely take time away from work, which is really important. They're given the bandwidth to care for sick parents. You know, my father eventually got quite ill and died. I mean, he was quite elderly, but you know, that also was another area where you know, you want to spend the time, but it's very hard to balance it with your work. So that's a big challenge. I think there are a lot of other challenges. You know, how do you approach work-life balance? How do you approach difficult interactions in the workplace? How do you balance your own passion for work and help other people within your group? How do you really understand what your goals are in your work? You know, do you move to have additional leadership opportunities? Do you stay where you are because it's better for your family not to keep moving? How do you balance all of those things? And then I think, you know, where you're later in your career, I think the balance is, again, you know, what do you want to accomplish with the remaining years you have in your career? And how do you balance that against what's really feasible and what's right for your family? So there are many challenges as you go through. I also think that, you know, for all of us, it's a challenge balancing the academic part of our work with the patient care. You know, patient care always comes first. We really have to manage that. There is an increasing emphasis on revenue generation in academic institutions where they're always losing money. So they've tried to have a sort of different model where, you know, they're all RVU-based now for most places. And how many half days you have of clinic is balanced in depending on what your goals are so that you can have people who are more clinically focused, who can see patients and enroll on trials. But most people in academics want to be doing something more academic as well. And I think that for people rising up now in academics, that's an increasing issue, is how do you balance the number of half days you're in clinic against your goals of doing clinical trials and moving forward? And how do you balance the investigator-initiated trials, which are really looked upon as being important parts of any cancer center, but that are generally not money makers, in fact, the money losers, against the need to do sponsored trials where you're contributing probably more to treatment change, maybe less to the understanding of biology, but and you may generate more revenue. So these are all challenges that we're facing, but I think that they're doable. And I think one of the key things to really communicate is the need for mentors and feedback. And those mentors can be at your institution and outside of your institution as well. And that's important. Sitting on the panel for Women in Oncology was fascinating, really understanding the challenges that my colleagues also dealt with over time and where they came to and the passion to work within the field of oncology and women's health that really drove them to overcome a lot of odds was really very inspiring. So one thing I also, I think, learned from the women in oncology is that we need to be sharing our stories. We need to be talking. We need to help women with their careers and to help women be able to do all the things they want to do, whether that's family or not, whether that's having a partner, whatever kind of partner you want, to really support people within that and to understand that that doesn't mean that you can't have a career in academics or in a community practice.
I think that anybody considering a career transition, you know, I said during our Women in Oncology Summit at Miami Breast, I, you know, had made the comment that it's always easier to think the grass is greener on the other side, but it's always important to take a step back and figure out what opportunities you have to fix things in your own yard, in your own grass. I think often we can approach our institutions, our bosses, our colleagues, and say, you know, I'm looking to make this change. You know, maybe you're interested in changing disease types. Maybe you're interested in narrowing your focus. Maybe you're interested in more research or more leadership. And if you don't tell someone, and maybe tell them more than once so that they really hear you. Maybe you need more support. And maybe you need to say, you know, if I don't have this, I think I'm going to need to be thinking about new career opportunities. You don't know for sure that you need the big transition. So, you know, first I would consider what opportunities you have at home. And then anytime you're transitioning, you just want to go in with the most clear set of, you know, perfect situations, negotiable situations. You know, what's your dream job really look like? What's your perfect vision? What are the things that, you know, if you had to negotiate and give up on, that you would be willing to let go of? And think about those things in context. If geography is the most important thing to you, if your entire family or entire support system is in Minnesota, you probably aren't going to interview for jobs in Florida. If the most important thing to you is being a breast oncologist and that place only has positions open for melanoma experts, it's probably not the right place for you. So, I mean, you need certain fits, but there's always times that there's flexibility in some of those features. And if you really widen your thinking and challenge yourself to be uncomfortable, which is really where our biggest growth can come from as humans, amazing things can happen.
I think we have unique challenges, and some of these include gender bias and stereotypes that can impact our opportunities for advancement and recognition. And this bias may manifest in hiring practices, promotion decisions, opportunities for leadership. I think another area that we discussed was work-life balance, right? So balancing professional responsibilities with personal and family obligations can be really challenging. And the demanding nature of what we do, the long hours, the on-call schedules, it can make it really challenging to achieve work-life balance. Additionally, I think women may experience obstacles related to childcare, family responsibility, and finding adequate childcare, managing parental leave, and returning to work after taking time off. So these are some unique challenges that we face. Another one would be addressing salary disparities, right? So this can sometimes be a sensitive topic, but we know that there are gaps that persist in salary, especially with women earning often less than male counterparts for comparable work. And this can contribute to a feeling of financial insecurity and, most importantly, to feelings of being undervalued. So I think, you know, as we develop a situation where we're seeing more women in leadership, this will be extremely helpful because having mentors and sponsors who can provide support, guidance, and advocacy for trying to address some of these challenges that we faced, I think is a really important part of our discussion.
Yeah, I mean, in the table, it was really interesting hearing about people, what they were interested in and where they wanted to go. And, you know, even somebody who's left community practice to go into a more academic role, but very clinically heavy at the age of 50. And how do you really deal with that? How do you get involved in trials and manage that? I think that also there were people who were in practice and busy in practice, and how do they balance their life outside of work? People who are in academic centers where they really have a huge amount of clinical work. And I think that there are recommendations that we can provide that are more individualized. It's hard to make a global recommendation, but I think the idea is to go forward with ideas, to start. You have to start to move forward. You have to have a leader within your group who supports what you want to do. That's key. And I think if you have somebody who doesn't support you and you know for sure that you don't want to do exactly what you're doing now, then you need to leave that institution to somewhere where they're going to support you for that. So for example, let's say you go to your leadership of your group and you say, I really want to do trials. And they say, well, you know, really, you're a clinician, you can't do trials. I think you have to then go back and really think about how important is that part to you, and balance it against where you are and what's right for you and your family in whatever that family looks like. And then make some difficult decisions, because a lot of times if that's, you're really pegged into a certain place, it's hard to move. If you are enrolling in trials, I think another thing you can do is to say, okay, bring a trial you want to lead, a sponsored trial, say, into your group. So, okay, I want to lead this trial here, and I'm going to really champion the trial. If you enroll really well in a trial and you talk to the trial leadership, there are possibilities of proposing sub-analyses of subgroups. That could be anything. You know, how do people with brown eyes do versus blue eyes? That's something that you then have the power to ask about, because you've really contributed in a big way to the study. That's not enrolling one or two patients, obviously, but it's making a big impact. And that was another thing we talked about, just that you really, you have to have contributed in order to then get something back. The cooperative groups are a place where people can also propose studies, although it takes a long time, and be successful. And then somebody else might have an investigator-initiated trial at another institution, and you join on, then you can propose a sub-study potentially. The only thing I would say is if you do take that approach, you have to get that set up early, because a lot of times the sub-studies go to the junior people at the institution that's running the trial.
When I think about work-life balance, I always say it's not the work-life balance, it's the work-life pendulum. I recently heard someone call it the work-life wrecking ball, which is hilarious. It's not a scale that's in balance. It's a scale that's swinging back and forth wildly. And so there are moments, days, weeks, months where I am an amazing researcher, physician, mom, wife. And there are days, moments, weeks, months, years where I am a terrible whatever. And those things swing back and forth. And I think that if you look at them in movement, it looks pretty great, you know? But I think that we have a tendency to be our own worst critics. And so when we're reflecting on that pendulum swinging, we only see the swing to the widest ends of the spectrum, to the bad places, on both the career side and the life side, which probably isn't fair. And so I think it's important to take stock about where you really are. You know, there's some really beautiful research that shows that there's something very empowering about having a word that describes how you're feeling. And then just by having the language for what you're feeling, you feel less alone in that feeling because you can name it. And so events like, you know, the Women in Oncology brunch at the Miami Cancer Symposium are powerful because, you know, women in oncology, men in oncology sit around and say, it's so hard to have preschool and early elementary school kids because they go to bed so early and you're rushing home and they're tired and cranky and they're crawling all over you and you're physically exhausted and you feel like you barely get to see them. And everybody else can say, I know that feeling. And just being seen and knowing that your experience is normal is so validating. And to sit with women saying, you know, my parents are sick. My parents have Alzheimer's, cancer, end stage, whatever. And I'm trying to manage their illness two cities, two states away, while my kids are in high school, is so validating because that distress and weight is something that everybody's familiar with. And so sometimes just being able to have the words to share the experience can really help us all come together, even if nobody has the perfect solution for it. And trust me, there's no perfect solution for it. We're all kind of making it up as we go along. But that's also the beautiful messiness of life.
Navigating this balance, especially during career transitions, can be particularly challenging. And to support women in oncology, there are various resources and policies that may be available, and if not, should perhaps be asked about or actually brought up. So some of these would include things like, depending on your role within an organization and whether it's appropriate, there may be a flexible work arrangement. For example, we're working part of the week remotely or even part-time. Organizations that promote a supportive workplace culture that values work-life balance and recognizes the importance of personal obligations can help women feel more supported, especially during periods of career transition. And then we spoke about the importance of mentorship and sponsorship as a resource. I would also say family-friendly policies, right, such as parental leave, childcare assistance, and flexible schedules can help women balance career aspirations with family responsibilities. And then the last resource that I would just highlight is the availability of professional development opportunities, right? Because things like leadership training, network events, and skills workshops can also help empower women to advance their careers.
I don't have a work-life balance. I have a work and do more work type of balance and do research on the weekends and at nighttime because it is an all-encompassing career. So I don't have a partner or children, so I don't have to worry about that aspect of my life somewhat. I'm learning to set boundaries with patients so that I can have more of a balance in my life. It's very important to have more of a support staff and build a team around yourself so that maybe you're not the one doing all of the phone calls. You have somebody that you really trust who can help you with those things. Mentorship is also very important. And seeing how other people balance their lives
is crucial. I think we don't do the best job of that as women in oncology, being able to balance everything without having help.
Mentorship is extremely important. And although this is something that has kind of been happening organically for years, sort of informally, I notice now it's quite a bit much more intentional, right? So I see junior faculty and even students coming to me and asking me outright, will you be my mentor? And I think that's a great change because it highlights the importance of making sure that you establish firmly that relationship. But I would just say in that regard, I think it's also important to differentiate between a mentor and a sponsor, right? So a mentor is someone who offers guidance, advice, and support to another person. And that could be regarding professional or personal issues. But a sponsor is someone who actively advocates for and supports another person's, in this case, career development or advancement. Sponsors actually use their influence and networks to create opportunities for those that they're supporting. So I'm referring to things like recommending your colleagues for promotion, introducing them to key contacts, or just championing their work within your own institution. As we think of transitions for women in oncology, it's important that we recognize the importance of not only having mentors, but also sponsors.
Mentorship is difficult because in order to become a good mentor, you have to have had good mentors. And there's not going to be one perfect person who is able to mentor you in all things. And so you have to pick up different people who are willing to mentor you and then carry those things forward. In medicine, we're used to having mentors because medicine is a series of apprenticeships so that we learn how to become breast oncologists or thoracic oncologists. There are certainly a lot of institutional kind of drives to mentor people of certain subgroups. There are a lot of women in oncology types of mentorship opportunities, but ultimately, you've got to seek out mentorship.
I think gender bias can look like a million different things. There's little tiny micro biases, and there's great big terrible events. I think I've experienced the full spectrum. We were talking about maternity leave, and I said, you know, as a fellow, I used part of my research time as maternity leave. And that's kind of an example of gender bias, right? Because that's where that maternal pay gap or maternal experience gap starts. I had less real research experience than my male colleagues because none of them had to use maternity leave for research. And you can certainly guess that I got less research done on home and maternity leave. There are examples of women being introduced as Stephanie rather than Dr. Graf when their male colleagues at the same podium or the same microphone are then introduced as Dr. X and Dr. Y, which is the smallest example. But when it's in contrast like that, whereas if everybody were just Stephanie, first name, first name, first name, it's not as uncomfortable as when you're othered like that. Those things just sort of catch your attention and feel uncomfortable. And then there's moments where it's more of the missed opportunity. There's an opportunity to travel to a meeting. There's an opportunity to take on a new leadership role. And you aren't asked, not because you're not capable, not because you're not thought of, but because the assumption is that as a woman and a mother and a caregiver and all of the other roles that are a part of our pendulum swinging, we wouldn't want it. Well, I should have the power to decide what's right for me and my family. And so those are the examples of gender bias that you don't even know that maybe you've missed out on, because nobody even gave you the opportunity to choose. And so I think that what's important is that we keep raising the conversation around these moments so that anytime one of us in leadership, and I'm going to put myself in that now because now I'm a senior oncologist in a leadership position, in many leadership positions, and when I'm thinking about who to invite for a talk, who to offer a leadership position to, it's important that I don't think, oh, well, she just had a baby, or her kids are still young, maybe it's hard to travel, and offer it broadly, or more importantly, post it publicly and let people apply so that it can be considered without those moments, and that you ask people what their preferred address is so that you get Dr. Graf right the first time, you learn to pronounce that last name correctly. All of those are just ways that we can do better globally.
I think just being able to reach out to somebody and talk to them about their story and understand where they're coming from can go a really long way in supporting them. But ultimately, we all have the same drive here, which is to develop breast cancer treatment strategies. And so that's one thing that binds us together. And of course, our patients bind us together as well. There's something that I really love about the doctor-patient relationship, because coming in, you both are there to learn from each other, to teach each other, and to advance someone's health care and make their life a little better, hopefully. I mean, we are poisoners at heart, to be honest. But that relationship is just such a beautiful, trusting relationship. And I think we should also give each other room to have that kind of trusting relationship with each other. And a lot of times what gets in the way is being very competitive, because we are competing on some level for different trials. And being kind to ourselves, patients, and each other, whether or not that's because we're in the same institution or different institutions, or you're male, female, in whatever group that you're in, is very important. My whole career, I did 19 years of education and training to go toward a translational oncology career, and so that is my goal. Goals are going to shift over time, but my goal, that's been the one guiding light, is that I want to be in research. I do love seeing patients. There's a lot of different ways to achieve different goals, but for me, being able to define those goals and move forward has been really important. I'm at a point in my career where I don't know if I'm in the right place, and I might move to a different place, and that's very scary, but I think that it's very important to me that I be able to at least give it a shot and be brave. That's something that was mentioned at our Women's in Oncology event, that sometimes we have our first job or second job, and moving to the second job might be a really great thing, a period of growth that we can't necessarily get at the place that we're in right now. Coming straight out of fellowship and into an attending position at the same institution, you don't know what you should be asking for to further your career goals. You might not even know what your career goals really are, because you're still just so new. Coming out of fellowship, you're trained to treat breast cancer patients, but you don't know the whole wide world of the business aspect of it, for example, or the customer service aspect of it. And so the goals can shift over time. If I could go back, I would change a few things in my breast cancer clinic, because in breast cancer, most of our patients are in the curative setting, and we need a lot of help. I would have set up my practice so that the patients knew from the beginning, we have a team, you can reach out to this person. This is also a safety net, instead of taking it all on myself. Because what's happened over time is that the breast cancer patients that I have, they know me and only me. And I really need to integrate nurse triage, nurse navigators. It would be great to have an advanced practice practitioner, just a whole team of people, so that they feel like I'm not the only person in their journey. I'm just one of a team of people who can get them through their breast cancer. We definitely need multidisciplinary work. Breast cancer more than anything, because they are used to having first biopsy of breast cancer. They're used to having a surgeon, maybe seeing a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist. Social and psychological care are very important. So it's a big team of people that can take care of one person and hopefully get them through it.
I think looking back, I would give my younger self a lot of advice. One of the things is, very often as we start our careers, I think we have prescriptive ideas or approaches in our mind of what our path should look like. And I know that I had some fixed ideas early on in my career. So I would give my younger self the advice to be flexible in seeking diverse experiences. Explore various facets of, for example, breast cancer research, if that's what I had known that I would have been interested in. So exploring different aspects of this would include things like not only clinical care, but also advocacy, public health, and this will really give you a broader view of what you're interested in. You might find out that you're passionate about something that you would have never known if you hadn't been flexible. And I think I would also emphasize the importance of building a professional network and doing that early on, cultivating relationships with mentors, colleagues, experts in the field, and network from across different sectors, including academics, community, advocacy, pharma. You know, all of these connections can come in handy. Embrace leadership opportunities and don't run from those things because you're scared of being in the spotlight, right? Those things can be intimidating or scary, but they actually help you grow. And finally, I think one last piece of advice I would give my younger self is to make sure to foster resilience and self-care. Recognize the emotional and physical toll of the work that we do and be very intentional in taking care of yourself. Find ways to disconnect and take care of yourself both physically and emotionally.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OnGlobe On Air, supported by Pfizer and Novartis. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onglobe.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OnGlobe is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OnGlobe. On Facebook, like us at OnGlobe and follow our OnGlobe page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OnGlobe On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OnGlobe On Air.